Good evening and welcome. It's KVC Arts, arts and entertainment, as well as the people and places providing it. I'm David Fleming. Tonight I'll be speaking with Steve Byrne, stand-up comedian, writer, and director. We'll hear about some of his experiences coming up in the world of comedy, including bombing on stage and hitting 13 stages in one evening. We'll hear about documentaries he's produced and directed, including one on the great Jonathan. The main focus of tonight, though, is on Byrne's directorial debut called The Opening Act. And while it is fiction, much of it is drawn from Byrne's own experiences. And it's brand new, having just come out October 16th. Steve will talk about the film in a second, but first, how can people see it?
Yeah, it's in select theaters or streaming VOD, Amazon, iTunes. So I guess if you want to travel to a red state and risk your health, you can go to a theater or you can watch it in the comfort of your own home.
I was in the middle of a mouthful of coffee when you said that, I have to
say.
Okay, well, so I'm sure you were able to speak about it quite nicely already, but after this run of interviews this morning, I'm sure it's really honed by now. Let's just get a nice synopsis of the opening act, and then we'll go from there.
Sure, yeah. A brief synopsis is, I went back to the early days. Every comic has had that last job they had before they took the plunge. So it was going back to those early days of this kid, Will Chu in the film, who works in insurance and gets offered his first time ever going on the road at a professional comedy club, opening for his idol, Billy G. And along the way, all the pitfalls, trials and tribulations that come with going to a comedy club for the first time, everything from understanding what the light is, comedy introductions, bachelorette parties, hecklers, and even doing morning radio interviews. So it's all there, all encapsulated within 4 days. And fortunately for us, our hero fails miserably at every step of the turn, much like I did throughout the course of my career.
I did read that this was a script written during your early days of stand-up and honing your craft in comedy. Is that correct?
Well, when I had a television show called Sullivan and Son that got canceled 2014, and I was right back on the road, and I thought, you know, the only way I seem to get any work in the city of Los Angeles is if I write something. So I thought, if I'm going to invest the time to write something, what's the one thing I'd want to see? And I thought, I've never seen a truly just great film about stand-up comedy, not about a relationship, not about anything else, just stand-up. And so I put pen to paper and took all my experiences from early on in my career into this film, because when I put pen to paper, I thought, I don't want to watch a film about a 50-year-old driving home from Las Vegas. I want to watch a film about a 20-year-old driving to Las Vegas for the very first time and experiencing everything fish out of water.
Oh, that's a really nice way of looking at that. Well, I noticed that a couple of the same producers for the opening act were the same as what you had for Sullivan and Son. We're talking about Vince Vaughn being one of them. You've been in a film with Vaughn and toured doing comedy with him. So when and how did you two meet initially?
We met initially. I had just moved to Los Angeles after being a New York City club comic. I was at this Comedy Cellar every night of my life, holidays, everything for 7 years. So I moved to L.A. thinking, all right, it's time to progress to the next step. And right when I moved here, I met a comic named Ahmed Ahmed, who was a regular at the Comedy Store. We hung out a few times, and they had just done the Wild West comedy documentary that Vince did about four upcoming comedians breaking into the comedy scene. So they were on the road, and they were going to Las Vegas. One of the guys got sick, and then Vince said, Ahmed, who do you know? And he said, this guy just moved here. They called me up. I went and did it. I got a standing ovation, and Vince and Peter were like, who the hell is this guy? And next thing I know, we're all like best friends. So it just kind of took off from there.
So how much of you or your experiences then have been written into the characters, be it Jimmy O. Yang's character or others, perhaps situations in the film?
Sure. Well, once Jimmy's character hits the road, everything in the film happened to me in real life.
Ah.
So this is all culled from true life experiences. You're going to say, did you really end up under a trailer in the woods while a couple was having sex above you at 3 a.m? It's like, yes, that really happened to me. Did you really bomb on the radio as horribly? Yes, that really happened to me. So all those things happen, and Jimmy's character is the MC, your introduction into the professional world of comedy. All those experiences are culled from my experiences. The feature act, the party boy, played by Alex Moffat, Chris Palmer, I was that guy for a few years, you know, feeling like a big fish in a small pond when you're going to Cedar Rapids or you're going to Toledo, Ohio, and you're the celebrity in town for the weekend. And then currently I am and have been, you know, Billy G, the headliner in the film, played by Cedric the Entertainer. So all those things have happened to me, but I would say that Billy G is named after Billy Gardell, who was somewhat of a mentor for me. Even though we were both headliners at the time, he's distilled so many great little nuggets of knowledge and information to me to help lead me to the right path of being a headliner. And one of the best lines in the film was given to me by Gardell years ago. He said, you know, I used to think when I was a younger comic, I had to make the audience laugh so that I feel good. Now I know I make the audience laugh so that they feel good, and that makes it the best job in the world. And that's from Gardell. It always stuck in my head like a one-hit wonder, and I'm glad it's in the film.
Nice. Well, there are, of course, a lot of comedians in the film, and many we'd know through their current or recent specials. Russell Peters, he may have been one of the last names mentioned on the blurb that I read, but he's the one that jumped out the most to me. He's one that you also shared a bill with on an early tour.
Yeah, I did this tour called the New Majority Tour, which was Russell Peters, Gabriel Iglesias, Lisa Lampanelli, and myself. So all the other minorities, I guess, were represented in that tour. And it was a lot of fun to get to do those arena tours and be exposed to working with everybody. I love Lampanelli because we always used to close out the shows at the Comedy Cellar together. We were the last two comics always at 1:45 or 1:30 in the morning at the Comedy Cellar. So after everybody left, we were kind of left. And, you know, it was great to reteam with her. But Gabriel Iglesias I love, and Russell Peters is literally one of the greatest comics I've ever seen at improv and crowd work. I think he's one of the fastest I've ever seen. He's amazing.
He's someone that I enjoy for the sake of he will do an accent of one culture or country or another, but it's not offensive when he does it. He's not some guy making fun of somebody. It's an accurate representation. It's amazing with him.
Yeah, and it's always done from an educated perspective, because if he's making fun of somebody, he's like, I was in so-and-so part of that town, and those people eat so-and-so this kind of thing. And he'll really get into the nuances because he's such an international act. He takes the time to go out, meet people, experience life. So he culls from all those experiences. And you're right, he does it from a very inclusive way. He's not excluding anybody at his shows. And that's why I think when you go to his shows, there's some of the most diverse audiences I've ever seen.
Incredibly, yes, yes. And that's one of the things that I love about seeing stand-up is a lot of the folks that you may not get along with, well, outside the club, once you get inside, it's people looking for a laugh, looking for a break from this horrible situation of a world that we're in right now.
Sure.
You know, speaking of bills, Bill Burr, going back to the opening act, but as seen on the trailer anyway, he's not so much of a stand-up comedian as, some sort of an office guy? Tell us about his character, please.
Yeah, I wanted to litter the universe that Jimmy lives in with stand-up comedians to represent tentpoles of their own experiences. So everybody's had a bad job, and everybody had that last job before they went off. So, you know, calling up Bill Burr and say, hey, would you play Jimmy's last boss? He said, of course, yeah, because he remembers his last occupation and his last boss. You know, when I had to ask Russell Peters, Eliza Schlesinger, and Brooks Whelan to come in for the scene to play the radio DJs, if I had cast actors, I would have said, okay, this is what it's like for a comedian to do morning radio. With these guys, it was like, look, you've done morning radio, you've been through the routine, you know it. They're like, yeah, we know it. I'm like, let's roll. And it was as easy as that. So all along the way with all the comics, even though they weren't playing comics, they knew the situations. And even though I may have ended up on a trailer or I may have bombed on the radio in Los Angeles, they have had some shared experience in every facet of this film. And I got to tell you, the most redemptive thing about doing this movie is having Neil Brennan, Russell, or Bill Burr, who's brutally honest with me. They all say the same thing after they saw the film. It's like verbatim. They say, I loved it. It was so authentic. And I have to go see my therapist because you brought up all these horrible memories that I thought I was over years ago. So I took that as a badge of honor. And that's why all these comics are in it, playing different acting roles.
Let's talk about casting versus asking. So I'm sure some of this was cast. I don't know if you had a casting agency or what the situation was. But of course, a lot of these folks would have been, hey, Russell, we've got this thing for you, or Bill, we need a snippy office guy.
Sure, yeah. I mean, that was the fun thing about this was, sure, we could have traditionally cast it with actors, but, you know, Julie Ashton and I, our casting director, have a great relationship, and even when I was on Sullivan and Son, she cast our show there, I think I was a pain in the butt because I was like, I know who's perfect for this, and I'd call Leslie Jones, and she did the show.
Oh, cool.
And so with this one, it was a lot of fun to just call my friends and go, would you come down for the day? And I will say, in this day and age, I haven't addressed this really yet, but you had to be careful with who you cast in the role too, because had we gotten, for example, let's just say we're at the beginning of the casting process and I cast Steve Martin as the headliner, and then let's say Alex Moffat, who's in the film, played the MC. Well, then all of a sudden you have to cast someone of color, because in the three main characters on the poster, you hope that there's some diversity, right, in this day and age. And a conversation I had that was very scary, I didn't enjoy having this conversation, was if we cast an African-American in the role of the feature act, and the feature act in this film represents kind of the party atmosphere and the person that's not taking the job so seriously, I said, you know, we're probably going to get raked over the coals if you cast a black actor in that role, because they're going to take it symbolically as, oh, so this is the guy that's just on the road to trying to get laid and doesn't take the job seriously. And I didn't want any of those conversations to happen, but I knew that they would if I cast it a certain way. So it was something I was hyper aware of, being in the comedy community, as much as we are pushing the envelope like Bill did on SNL and pushing back against, you know, political correctness or cancel culture. Mm-hmm. I still wanted this to have the impact that I wanted it to have and just cast the best people for the job and not have to worry about those things. And thank God casting worked out the way it did, and I didn't have to worry about those things.
That's really wonderful that you were able to think about, you know, it's not so much what you're putting into it, but you know that no matter what you say, someone is going to read something into it. I always go to the grad student approach where they're just spilling over with knowledge and raking someone over the coals. With both Sullivan and Son and the opening act, we're dealing with these real existential crisis kind of ponderings. Sullivan and Son, we'll go into this a little bit later, but it's a man who gives up what should be a really successful career and goes to become a bar owner. We're dealing with these ponderings of what and how and if, and maybe I should such and such. Of course, part of this is simply character development and a plot device, but I am also a theater geek, by the way. But again, I have to wonder if there was anything in your life where, you know, as you were coming up in the world of comedy, when you were going from a theater student at Kent and then becoming a stand-up act instead of a professorial type of career path might be more secure.
You know, it's funny you mention it, because I do think at the time in my life when I was doing these things, when I was writing these things, there were things I was going through. When I wrote Sullivan and Son, I was at a point in my life where I was giving everything I had to my professional career and not enough to my personal career. And I had met my wife around that time, and we had just gotten married. And the basis of Sullivan and Son was not going all in on your professional life, but maintaining a balance between the personal and professional. And that's what Steve Sullivan was trying to do. He said, I've given everything to law, but I'm not happy. It's not fulfilling. So if I can make a living that I'm passionate about and still be around friends and give the time to the people I care about, then it's a double win. And that's what Sullivan and Son was built on. And even with this film, I was looking back on those early years as I'm getting older and having some more retrospect with my career. I was just thinking, yeah, you want to make a great film about stand-up comedy, but hopefully along the way to let people know, especially, I guess in some small way, because I'm Korean and Irish and opportunities have been so limited for me, that it was like, why not tell somebody who's on the fence about something, go for it. You got nothing to lose, especially if you're in your 20s. If you're in your 20s, you got a year or two or three or four to make major mistakes, and you can always recalibrate and pivot back to that safe job. But at least go for it, and then you won't regret it the rest of your life. I think that song by The Killers, Caution, is great. You know, it's some kind of sin to spend your whole life living on a might-have-been. And that came out around the time that this film was starting to come out. And I thought, boy, if we could afford it, that would be great to put in the movie. But we can't afford, you know, the Killers track with an independent budget. So I think that's really the basis of it.
I was surprised that you weren't about to quote an Oasis song. I read that that was one of your
bands. Oh, that's every jukebox I've ever been to in an Irish pub. I always hijack it. I put my 20 in. I listen to Oasis, and everybody's drinking on my tab.
Beautiful. I'm David Fleming in conversation with comedian Steve Byrne. We're speaking mainly about his new film, The Opening Act. Go to stevebyrnelive.com for more. That's stevebyrnelive.com. Later in the program, we'll hear about his documentary on The Amazing Jonathan, also something which never made it past the pilot stage. It's based on a Japanese game show called Drunken Businessmen. And more about the film, The Opening Act. You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR. Streaming live at kvcrnews.org. You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR. Streaming at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. Tonight I'm speaking with stand-up comedian, writer, and director Steve Byrne. His new film, called The Opening Act, has just been released. Back with him in just a moment. But first, if you are a part of our recent fall membership campaign, thank you so much. We heard from quite a number of renewing members as well as new friends. And if you were meaning to give during the campaign but weren't able to get to it, or if you'd like to just step forward right now with a pledge of financial support, just go to kvcrnews.org/support. Then you're just a few clicks away from being a listening, contributing member. Let's go back now to Steve Byrne. We'll hear more about the film, The Opening Act, but also lessons learned from bombing on stage. And up in just a bit, hitting 13 different stages in one night, filmed as a documentary. You mentioned the professional career versus personal career. When you were doing stand-up every night in New York before coming out to L.A., did you have the day job? What was paying the bills and all that? And comedy was really off to the side, or were you making a living as a comic at this point?
Yeah, in New York City, I moved there. You know, I never intended to be a stand-up. I never thought I'd ever be a stand-up. I was studying theater, and I thought I was going to be an actor, right? And my father grew up in Brooklyn, and he moved back to New York City after I was in college. And I said, can I crash on your couch and experience New York? He said, of course. And the first day I got there, I told my folks, I said, I'm not coming home until I get a job. And I started on 86th and Broadway. I made my way down to 50th and Broadway. There was a gentleman in the doorway that happened to be a manager. I gave my resume. He said, what do you want to do? I said, I will do anything. I just want to work. He said, fill this out. Come back tomorrow. That place was Caroline's Comedy Club. And I was sweeping floors, and I was watching all the comics. And every Tuesday, they'd have a young comic talent showcase with all these young comedians in New York City. And it was packed, and it was so fun. I thought, I think I could do that. And September 30th, 1997, I tried stand-up for the first time, and I always tell people it's like the first time I had sex. It was quick. I cried afterwards, and I couldn't wait to do it again. So that's what it was like for me. And I was hooked, and I started doing stand-up while I was working at Caroline's. And then within a few months, I was making money as a comic, and I was able to quit. And it happened pretty rapidly for me. I got a manager my second time ever on stage. So it's definitely not the norm, but I was working pretty quickly. So I was excited. And it's a badge of honor to have passed at the Comedy Cellar and been a part of that scene. And still, when I go back, I can and reconnect with all those comics I started off with and then see all the young comics taking the mantle and making comedy their own. And comedy has pivoted and changed so much even in the last 23 years. It's exciting to be a part of.
You mentioned when you were at Kent State, you wanted to be an actor. Is that what your intentions were with the degree at that point? Certainly not stand-up.
Yeah, certainly not stand-up, but certainly I was always fascinated with acting, and I took some class when I was younger. I played hockey all my life, so I kind of put it on the back burner. And once I got to college, I was like, what do I really want to do? What do I want to be passionate about? And acting was that. I was never cast in one production at the university, but I was always cast in like things down at like the Cleveland Playhouse and, you know, outside. So I was able to work professionally as an actor, but not as a starving college student, which to me was always ironic. So the city of Cleveland and the theaters that they did have, I was able to work those things, but never got cast. So it was very odd. And I find that that's always the situation, you know, even within the industry here in Los Angeles, where I just don't have the opportunities. I, for some reason, am not an industry darling, but I wrote one television sitcom and it got made and it was on the air for 3 years. I wrote one screenplay. And here we are talking about it, and I think it's pretty damn good. So I think I have the talent. I just, for some reason or another, there's this weird conundrum where things don't connect with who it should. But at the end of the day, all I have to connect with is the audience. That ultimately is all that matters.
I think that the opening act has a real shot at that kind of thing because of the different representations that we were speaking about earlier, whether or not it's this character or that character, and it's going to be a lot of different people represented. This should be something that most people should be able to relate to at least one or three or seven of the characters in some way.
Yeah, for sure. And I never intended, I think any time you see a bus poster or an advert where you could just tell they force cast diversity. I cast my friends in this film. So, for example, Punky Johnson, who just became a new cast member of SNL, she was the bartender at the Comedy Store. Oh, and she just became a past regular. And I called her one day on a whim. I said, hey, can you please come down and do a scene for me and be the MC? She said, of course. And lo and behold, now she's on SNL. So I didn't say, okay, I got to find, you know, a woman who is a lesbian that is African-American, that is a comedian, to put her in here to check that box off. It was just like, no, I'm just going to call my friend. And that's how it happened, you know?
It's, again, really fortunate to be able to have such a group of people to be able to call on, which takes me to, again, those early days when you were washing dishes at the comedy club that you were at that point, but being able to watch all these people, and this is before being actually taken under the wing by anybody, this had to be just the university of comedy for you, where you're, well, maybe I won't be the Korean-Irishman starring in Oklahoma next semester.
That's right, yeah. I learned so much from those comedians. I really think, look, I went to Kent State University, but the Comedy Cellar, the Comic Strip, Stand Up New York, Gotham Comedy Club, the Stand in New York, those clubs gave me my education in stand-up comedy. You learn so much from those audiences. You learn the comfortability of talking about race because it's a melting pot in New York City. Nobody's uncomfortable talking about it. And even like this is one of those great examples of being a comic in New York City. So Godfrey's the host, and at the Comedy Cellar on a Tuesday night, people pop in all the time at the Comedy Cellar if they're doing Letterman at the time or any of the late night talk shows. So Tuesday night, people pay $10 to be there. It's a great roster of just New York comics, and then Robin Williams comes in. And Robin does 40 minutes, and the place is like elated that Robin Williams comes in. So Godfrey goes back up, and he goes, ladies and gentlemen, I know you just saw Robin Williams. You're never going to believe this. Ray Romano comes up, does great kills. The audience is losing their mind. Godfrey goes back up on stage again. He goes, guys, I'm not making this up. This is crazy. Chris Rock. These people, they're like from Ohio, right? They paid $10 at the Cellar. They just saw Robin Williams, Ray Romano. Now they're seeing Chris Rock. Godfrey goes back up again. He goes, guys, it's just one of those nights. I don't even know what to say anymore. Dave Chappelle. Chappelle goes up and kills. This audience is losing their mind. I'm a comic. I'm losing my mind. This is like one of the greatest nights I've ever seen. Godfrey goes back up. He goes, guys, you can't make this stuff up. Eddie Murphy. The audience is standing up. They're giving a standing ovation. And then Godfrey goes, nah, I'm just joking. Steve Byrne, ladies and gentlemen. And then I went up and I proceeded to bomb the first 5 minutes and navigate my way. And then it was like one of those things where I was glad I went up on stage because most comics, if you're younger, you think, I can't follow that. I can't go up. But then you realize the audience doesn't care. They paid $10. They're there to see comedy, and they're not judging you by those standards. Grace periods give you 2 minutes, whether you're Seinfeld or Rock. I've seen everybody, and they're trying out new material. You get 2 minutes, and then you got to bring the goods. And that's all that matters, and that's what I learned in that moment. And it gave me the confidence, along with 1,000 other things I learned at the Comedy Cellar and all those clubs in New York, that made me a better comic, that made me ready for all the experiences that you're about to have, as opposed to the young character in the opening act. You see it unfold and unpack that he's not prepared for anything.
You know, I suppose I did initially think, yeah, how could I follow that? You know, when you're going on and you have all these just a veritable who's who of some of the best in comedy preceding you. Yeah, how could I follow that? But really, only when you were speaking about it, it seemed more like, well, you know what? They just primed the well, as it were. They got the audience ready to laugh. And by this point, you could bomb, and they still would laugh.
Yeah, you know, I recently was at Gotham Comedy Club in New York City. I was there to do my headlining spot. In other words, people there, they paid to see me, and, you know, you get dressed up in a suit, and you do your time. And Sal Volcano from the Impractical Jokers was coming in to do a guest set. And he's on television, so any club manager would be elated to have somebody on TV and relevant to go up on their stage and be part of the show. Well, I show up with Sal, and the manager says, Sal, I'm sorry you can't go up tonight, which means, whoa, what's going on here? We walk in the showroom. Seinfeld's on stage, and Seinfeld does a half hour. Seinfeld finishes. Dave Chappelle comes in. He does a half hour. And now I got to go up afterwards, and if I didn't have that experience from the Comedy Cellar, I might be a little nervous, but I went up, I did my time, and the audience gave me a standing ovation, I think partly because they had a great time, partly because I gave it my all, and they saw me sweating up a storm to make sure they had a good show to keep up with those names, but also because I held my own against those guys, you know? So I was really proud of that moment, and again, it wouldn't have happened if not for my degree in comedy from New York City.
Wow. Wow. I'm David Fleming in conversation with comedian Steve Byrne. We're speaking mainly about his new film, The Opening Act. Find more on Facebook and elsewhere, including Wikipedia, but the best stop may be at stevebyrnelive.com. That's B-Y-R-N-E. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR. Streaming live at kvcrnews.org. Find many past KVC Arts programs via podcast through NPR One, iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play, and all past shows are at kvcrnews.org/arts. I had wanted to talk about this anyway, and you did mention bombing on stage, and we're really, in the opening act, we get the impression that Jimmy Yank's character bombs, I mean bombs to the nth degree. So we did speak about this coming from your personal experiences or stories from other folk, just that actor's nightmare kind of thing. Oops, there's another theater thing. Christopher Durang, everybody. Okay.
There you go.
But I'd like to hear about some of the bombing on stage and maybe the situation, but really more importantly, what you learned from it, whether it's how to handle the heckler or the drunk or the person who's just too stoned, you know, whatever the case is.
Yeah, look, you come to learn that bombing, not doing well, a joke bombing, etc., it's part of the job. And once you understand you're going to fail, stand-up comedy truly, as much as you go to a comedy club and you laugh, it's a profession of failure. 9 out of 10 new jokes are going to fail. So you watch an hour special. Those are a bunch of small victories all put together in 60 minutes. What you don't see is the thousands of minutes that went into putting that together, trial by fire. There's a lot of failure that goes along with it. And so you're seeing Jimmy over the course of, you know, 90 minutes fail repeatedly, not just with stand-up, but getting the headliner's introduction right, all the small things that come with being a professional comedian. So I always equate bombing to getting permanent marker on your face. It's going to be there for a little bit. It's going to wear off, but it's going to stick with you. And once you get over that, it's just like going up a 10-meter diving platform. You're going to be nervous the first 100 times you do it. But that 101st time you do it, you're kind of like, all right, you know what? I might land sideways. I might do a belly flop as I attempt this gainer or whatever it might be. But you're going to do it, and you're going to get used to it. And that's just part of the profession.
With several films and specials and documentaries under your belt by now, these are, I believe, still available for viewing and or purchase. I'd love to hear about 13 or Bust. This goes back to 2003.
Sure, yeah. 13 or Bust was a documentary I did that's available on YouTube for free, where I tried to break the record for most sets in one night in New York City. And at the time, Dave Attell had the record of 12. And in doing so, I think the audiences see what it's truly like to be a stand-up comedian in New York City. So you literally do your 15-minute set, you get in the cab, off to the next club for 10 minutes, and then you do the next set for 15 minutes, and so on and so forth. And we started at 6 p.m. We went till 3 in the morning, and it really is a fair representation of what it's truly like, from doing one set at one club and it doing great to literally doing the same exact set at the next club and just crickets. And then along the way, Bill Burr's in it. You see Bill Burr with hair, which tells you how old this is. But it was a lot of fun. It's a fun little time capsule to look back on. I saw it recently. I hadn't seen it since we did it 17 years ago. And to see how young and sprite I was, I don't think I could ever do that again these days at 46 years old, doing 13 shows. And then a young comic in New York City named Aaron Berg did 25 sets in one day. And I thought, oh, my God, I thought my record was pretty well intact, but to see that, it's crazy.
That is crazy.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. And by the way, it's worth noting that I had accidentally written this down as 3 or Bust. So now that people know the scenario, 3 or Bust would certainly be less impressive.
Sure.
You did 13. Was it because there were 13 clubs available, or was it because that's one more than the record was?
That's one more than the record was. I honestly did not think we'd beat the record, because I've had so many nights where you walk out and you can't get a cab. So I thought, at least one of these shows, we won't get a cab. But that was a miracle night where every time we walked out, a cab happened to be there. And we certainly lucked out. It was a lot of fun doing it. And it really makes me nostalgic to those years, because you could literally just make your living doing those 15-minute sets in New York City. Right now, I could just leave and go to New York and make a living just doing stand-up just at those clubs. It was a lot of fun. I had a total blast.
Wow. Was it 2006 that things really started to take off for you? I'm saying this because this was when your first Comedy Central special was aired, and you had a string of them for a while, one every, a couple of years perhaps?
Sure, yeah. I had a lot of hour specials. I had a lot of luck with those. In 2006, yeah, that's when I think it was voted fourth most popular of all time on Comedy Central. So that was nice to see. It was nice to see that all that hard work was paying off. And then these last few years, as my resume got more and more stacked, again, the opportunities just weren't there. Unless I write for myself, you know, I just don't get those opportunities. So I don't know what the disconnect is, but I will say that even with this film, as I had an hour prepared and couldn't get anybody to kind of jump on board to help me with it, the material is the best I've ever written in my life. This film came along, and I wrote and directed it, and it's coming out. I think it's the best representation on celluloid about my profession. It's a love letter to my profession. And I will tell you, after all these no's and rejections and everything, the whiskey at the after party tastes a lot sweeter when you got a lot of dirt underneath your fingernails. And I will go to my grave saying that. So I'm really proud of this film.
That's a quote I did not expect. After we get done, I'm going to be writing that one down. That's one of those. And how does one even end up on Comedy Central as far as these specials? Are you actually sending something in to them, or are they contacting you, or is it more like you're performing somewhere anyway and you sign a waiver saying, hey, Comedy Central may grab this?
I think at the time, a lot of the executives that worked for Comedy Central lived in New York City. So I was making the rounds and they'd heard of me. I didn't have a manager. I didn't have an agent. So I basically was at the Cleveland Improv and I filmed myself doing a half hour of my material. I sent it to the woman, Joanne Grigioni, who was booking there at the time, just kind of cold called and sent her a letter saying, hey, I'm Steve Byrne. I'd love to be, you know, considered for a half hour. And a month later, I got an email from her saying, you got a half hour. And I, once again, I just did it myself. I didn't rely on anybody. And I think, I think it comes down to the wherewithal of the individual, especially in this industry. It's always going to come down to you. The person that's going to work hardest for you is not a manager or an agent. It's you. You've got to create your own opportunities. You've got to work harder than everybody. You've got to outwork everybody. And that's certainly some of the knowledge that Cedric's character dispels to Jimmy O. Young's character in the film, too.
Cool. When a person is doing a special, you will most often see directed by so-and-so, and sometimes it's another comic. I believe Margaret Cho directed Selena Luna's special that they're shopping around right now, and we hope to see it out soon. But in a case of directing a comedy stand-up act, is that a case of somebody looking at the footage afterwards and saying, okay, this didn't play so well with the people in the front row? Let's not, you know, how does directing something like this work?
Well, I think directing an hour special, it's not that difficult, really. I mean, there's maybe 10 angles you could do. It's really just calling the edit and saying, on this edit, when they land the punchline, cut to the audience. You know, when they're setting up the joke, go to a wide. As they're getting closer to the punchline, close in. And when they deliver the punchline, really close in. And that's kind of it. I don't think there's much to directing an hour special. I think, if anything, you're working on the aesthetics, you're working on the tone, visually, how it might appear or look. You know, Bill Burr a few years ago did a black and white special. So it's like creative decisions like that. But ultimately, you want the aesthetic to match the performer. I think that's really kind of what a director would be gearing towards. But there's just not much to it because it's all written and personified by the comic on stage.
Gotcha. So it's not so much a case of like a director in a stage theater show. It's more of the technical director saying, take this shot. He's doing a joke about a blonde. Zoom in on somebody in the audience that's blonde, that kind of thing.
Yeah, there's just not much.
Okay.
There really isn't much to it. Yeah.
You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR. Streaming at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. Many past KVCR's programs are available by podcast through iTunes, NPR One, Spotify, as well as Google Play. And all past shows are at kvcrnews.org/arts. Thanks for listening, and thanks for contributing any time of the year at kvcrnews.org/support. Let's go back now to conversation with comedian Steve Byrne. We're speaking mainly about his new film, The Opening Act, though we're about to touch on more documentary work and some other projects which didn't necessarily get launched. When I'm speaking to folks about how people can follow them, whether it's Facebook or Twitter and all that kind of thing, sometimes MySpace will come up as a joke.
Sure.
And just we'll laugh about the fact that we even mentioned MySpace. But you were the winner of the MySpace stand-up or sit-down competition on TBS. Can you Tell us about this, please.
Look, I'm a comic, and I think anybody who's slightly artistic views a competition as, can you really judge the difference between Mitch Hedberg or Chris Rock? It just like, you know, they're both enjoyable in their own right. I don't know how you say one is better than the other, but right. Ultimately it was a social media marketing ploy. So you're trying to engage your fan base to get them to vote for you, and that's ultimately what happened. But the good news for me is I worked and met some other great comics that were in the competition. They were all professional comics, and I won $50,000 out of it. Mm. And because I got that $50,000, I put it down on a loft in downtown Los Angeles, and that was the first nice thing I ever bought myself as a professional comic. I think everybody has that moment. It's like, you know, do I buy myself a nice watch? I was like, oh, I'll go to the Sizzler and get a great steak, you know. Yep, I'll treat myself. But this was the first thing where I was like, I got a little money in my pocket. I can do something with this. And I bought a loft, so it was kind of cool.
Oh, that's totally cool. I think one of my first actual theater paychecks that I ever got, I bought my first CD player. So buying a loft in L.A. is much more impressive. That's pretty incredible.
Well, it was just before the recession hit in 08, so it was when everybody was buying property. So you didn't have to put much down, but I survived.
Nice. Beautiful. I think that's about the time we bought, too. And we live in Redlands. I'm not too far away from L.A.
Beautiful.
And all that. And I'm working in San Bernardino at the moment. Well, so gosh, we'll just skim through a lot of these things on the Chappelle Show, History Channel's History of the Joke, also with Jimmy Kimmel and Carson Daly. So many other folks and shows in here, including the Showtime comedy series Live Nude Comedy. There may be three things wrong with that title, but,
yep.
Well, two things. Okay.
Yeah.
But you also, the one that I want to hear about is that you shot a pilot for the G4 network based on a Japanese game show called Drunken Businessman.
Yes.
Okay. I've seen I Survived a Japanese Game Show. That was fun. But what is this? This just called to me for whatever reason.
Well, they called me to do the show, and I thought, okay, this sounds crazy. And they showed me the Japanese game show, Drunken Businessman. And what they would do is they would wait in the, like, I guess if you lived in New York City, like the Wall Street area of Manhattan, wherever that is in Tokyo, mm-hmm. and they'd find these Japanese businessmen that would stumble out of bars drunk. Mm-hmm. And they would have three of them on the sidewalk do a game show and try to answer questions. And it was so nonsensical. It was absolutely hilarious. It was one of the funniest things I'd seen. So where can you do that in the States? Well, we did it in Las Vegas on the sidewalk as people are walking up and down the strip. And we had this game show, and you could go in a phone booth. And it's really just like having fun but playing along with the drunkenness of hopefully some playful drunks. And obviously people are inebriated. You get them to sign a release, and then the next day they're just like, what did I sign? No. So we heard from a lot of the attorneys, and obviously that's why the show never made it to air.
Okay. That's unfortunate. I would love to go YouTubing and find some of these. Quick side note, of the many folks that you've opened up for, this one really took me by surprise when I read it. Kanye West. You opened up for Kanye West. Well, one, how did this happen?
We had both just done Last Call with Carson Daly in New York City when that show was still on the air. And the next week, he was doing a State University of New York's college performance. And so they asked if I could open for him. The show was at 8 o'clock. I, of course, was there at 7:15. 8 o'clock, he's not there. 8:15, he's not there. Okay, well, Steve, can you go on stage and hopefully he'll get here soon? I go on stage at 8:15. I do my 20 minutes. I get off stage. They go, he's still not here. Can you go back out again? I was like, oh, my God. I did my closing joke. I did everything I have, you know. This is early in my career. So I'm like, okay, I'll go back out. You want to please people? I come off stage. Yeah, Kanye's not here. Can you go back out again? I'm like, guys, I have nothing left in the tank, but I guess so. I'll give you 10 minutes. I go back out. The audience knows something wrong. I'm not doing well. I come off stage. They go, hey, he's still not. I'm like, this is not my problem. I gave you, you know, two extra performances. I'm out of here. I left. I called my agent. He said that Kanye West showed up 2.5 hours late for the show. He did three songs, and he got paid 10 times what you got paid. And I just thought, good to be in show business.
Oh, good God. Wow.
Yeah.
Truth be told, I had a follow-up written down that was he a surprisingly laid-back and funny and warm person? But I guess we never found out.
I'll never know.
Yeah. All right, let's readdress Sullivan and Son. It ran for, what, two, three seasons, I believe?
Three seasons.
Okay.
Yes, yes.
Now, this came out early 2012, somewhere in there.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe I read somewhere that this was intended to maybe complement, run at the same airtime or in tandem, I don't know, with Family Guy?
Oh, boy. That I don't know about. Okay. I think it was meant to accompany Big Bang Theory because they were trying to do more multicams. Yeah.
That's it. Okay, okay. Well, talking about Sullivan and Son, we touched on it earlier. Let's talk about this. This is the successful lawyer deciding to go back east and own a bar.
Yeah, Sullivan and Son was just a story where, you know, at the time I was learning to give myself more to my personal life as opposed to my professional life. I was so enamored and infatuated with building up my resume as a comedian. So I just thought, I want to do a show that's the foundation of the lead character, but also it pays homage to all the great multicams I loved. I love Married with Children. I love Cheers growing up. I love Martin. So Rob Long, who was the executive producer of Cheers for many years, jumped on board with me. We made an authentic, really, really paid homage to all those great multicams, and we had a show that was full of hard jokes, young comedians, TV veterans, and it was some of the best years professionally of my life to go to the Warner Brothers lot and see Christine Ebersole or Brian Doyle Murray or Roy Wood Jr. on set, and we had an absolute blast. You know, we filmed on the Warner Brothers lot, and after every taping, the show takes place in a bar. The bar turned into an actual bar. So we would plug the jukebox in, we'd play whatever songs were on there, we attached the kegs to the taps, and every episode we had nothing short of a great time. It was so fun.
Did you play Oasis on the jukebox once that was plugged
in? A lot of Oasis, a lot of The Killers. And then on the jukebox, it had a lot of old country, like really, really old country, which was a lot of fun. So it was just good vibes.
Wow, going from Champagne Supernova to Walking the Floor Over You, that kind of a...
That's right, yeah.
Fun. There's another one that took me by surprise, and this is another one of your documentaries. Not the surprise that you did something like this, but I used to really enjoy The Amazing Jonathan. This was something, I couldn't tell you how old I was when I first started seeing him, but something about combining comedy with some of my favorite slasher films and all this coming together for The Amazing Jonathan. One, did you just also grow up enjoying him and then eventually meeting him? And then we're leading to eventually you got this documentary together about him.
Yeah, when I was a young comic in New York, I hit the road. And the first club I performed at professionally on the road was Charlie Goodnight's, and I was there for 2 weeks, so it would be financially a win. And the first week was Brian Regan. The second week was The Amazing Jonathan. So these are the first two headliners I'm working with on the road.
Wow.
And Jonathan and I got along really well, and his assistant, Joel Osborne, and I got along extremely well because we were trading Oasis bootlegs at the time on CD. So it was a good core, and every time I went to Vegas, I'd visit them. They'd hook me up with a room. I'd crash with them. I'd hang with them. And the relationship carried on for years. And when Jonathan was given the terminal diagnosis, I, like everybody else, felt horrible. And then he outlived expectations, and 2 or 3 years later says, I'm going to go back on the road. And I thought, what a great impetus for a documentary. I'd love to see that about Jonathan because I love watching him. He's such a dynamic stage presence and so forceful and so funny. And so I started to play out the narrative in my head. I was like, Jonathan's the face of the film. Go through his career. He met Joel Osborne when Joel was 12, took Joel under his wing, hired him at 18 to work for him. So you have an Australian kid leaving Australia, coming to Las Vegas, being in charge at 18 years old of a drug addict in Las Vegas that oversees a suicide attempt, drug addiction, perils of Las Vegas, gets Jonathan's life on track. Joel moves back to Australia, becomes a comedian in his own right. Jonathan goes back on stage after learning he's dying and does one last tour. Joel comes back to open for him. The whole relationship comes full circle. I thought, that would be a great documentary. So I pitched it to them both. They said, yeah, we did it. It's on YouTube. Always amazing. It's closing in on 1 million views within a year. And I'm super proud of it.
So this is not just looking at The Amazing Jonathan as we know of him, you know, maybe one of the early HBO stand-up specials or something like that. I couldn't tell you where I first saw him. But actually seeing this guy develop this shtick of combining some genuine magic tricks on stage. But then, of course, a lot of it is really a setup for, I don't know, a bloody hand, that kind of thing. Did you actually explore this guy who would become the Amazing Jonathan, exploring maybe at one point he was just a stand-up act, and then he had to invent, well, let's do this magic routine?
Yeah, he was a failed magician coming out of high school and moved to San Francisco and became a street performer. And it wasn't until he got booked in Alaska at a strip club that he realized nobody wants to see anything I do, so I need to do something. So he had his friend send him a book of insult jokes. So he memorized all the insults and started throwing the insults at the customers. And then he started bleeding comedy into his magic, and then he went back to San Francisco and got passed at the Holy Zoo. And from there out, he met Robin Williams, Dana Carvey, Paula Poundstone, Ellen DeGeneres, and was part of this whole comic movement in the 80s that boomed out of San Fran. And from there, he was unstoppable. He was a force to be reckoned with and a Vegas headliner for many years.
It was funny you mentioned bleeding magic into comedy.
That's true, yeah. It's funny because he mentioned it in the film. He used to do this trick that Houdini did where he puts razor blades in his mouth and then pulls them out of his mouth. They're all tied together on a string. And he said while he was street performing, a guy came up to him and said, hey, I have blood capsules. You should use a blood capsule and make that part of the routine. And once Jonathan did that, it changed his performance and career. And then he became, as you mentioned earlier, the Freddy Krueger of comedy.
Wow. And we actually have him talking about it. This is somebody else telling a story about it, that moment with the blood capsule.
Jonathan talks about that story in the documentary, yeah.
Oh, wow. Incredible. Incredible. Where can folks find these? I know that you've got your website. How about Facebook and tweeting, if you do? Where can folks follow you, find you, and get your material? Again, a lot of these stand-up specials and these documentaries, these are available on various platforms.
Sure. Everything I have is at Steve Byrne Live. My website, steveburnlive.com. And, you know, the opening act, it opens in select theaters and then streaming VOD, Amazon, iTunes, all that stuff. The Amazing Jonathan documentary is available on YouTube for free. Just type in Always Amazing. And then my website has all four of my hour specials.
Oh, perfect. Perfect. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, gosh, Steve, I greatly, greatly appreciate your time. This was enjoyable and for me, and, well, just thanks a bunch.
Thank you so much for that, and thanks for the great conversation. It's a nice way to end the day.
It's been stand-up comedian, writer, and director Steve Byrne for the entirety of tonight's KVC Arts. Once again, more information on Byrne's directorial debut, that's the opening act, in theaters and streaming now. Information at stevebyrnelive.com. That's S-T-E-V-E-B-Y-R-N-E live.com. Thanks again to Steve Byrne and here at KVCR, Lillian Vasquez, Rick Dulock, and Shireen Awad. Many past KVC Arts programs are available as podcasts through iTunes, NPR One, Spotify, as well as Google Play, and all past shows are at kvcrnews.org/arts. You can also now tell your smart speaker to play KVCR. Music beds and themes heard on KVCR is composed and performed by Sean Longstreet, so thanks to Sean as well. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support.